Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Most of the foods we eat, we assume, come from specific places, but they have travelled about far more than you might think. Mike Gibney is the author of Food Through the Ages, a popular history, and joins us now on News Talk. Afternoon, Mike.
It's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
Now, people will probably be familiar with tarducken, stuffing, you know, animals inside other animals. How old is that practice?
It goes right back to the Middle Ages when it became extremely fashionable to stuff little birds into bigger birds and bigger birds into huger birds and so on. And it was partly due to the fact that when the harvest was in and the frost came, farmers, landowners, big landowners had really nothing to do, and they went bird hunting and shooting. And so there was a lot of fowl around, and the more ostentatious you could be about it, the better. I mean, blackbirds in a pie were not uncommon.
Yes. And how do you go about, I mean, if several animals are stuffed aside another animal, I would imagine it's difficult to carve. There's a lot of bones in there.
I think they're all deboned in some way or other.
Right, okay.
And the last one, I think, is left intact.
Right, okay. And but how many centuries back is this back? Or it's called ingastration.
Ingastration, yes.
Yeah.
It goes back to the 15th century.
Yeah.
And probably earlier than that, but that's sort of the first recorded time of it.
Yeah. Another interesting thing is that the Italians didn't invent pasta. Where did it come from?
It came from North Africa, from the Arabs who conquered the large parts of the south of Spain. And they brought this hard wheat with them. And when they eventually left, the Italians took it up in style, and they kept it and made it into pasta.
Yeah, and as people would probably be aware, like there's hundreds of different sorts of pasta within Italy.
Absolutely.
Why is there so many different sorts? What's the thinking behind that?
Well, a lot of people think it's the whim of an engineer. One guy likes to, or one lady likes to make it flat, another round. And the answer is it has to do with what it's used for. So although we have spaghetti with a meat sauce, ideally speaking, the spaghetti should just be with a very light, cheesy, oily sauce because it's intended to just coat the pasta. Now, if you have a ragu, then you need something that's going to wrap it up. So you could use a penne or a tagliatelle. Now, a penne is designed with a nib at one end, hence its name, penne, and it's ribbed on the outside. So it's all designed to hold pieces of meat together when you're eating it. So there was a reason for all of it.
Yes, but even in localities, if you travel around Italy, people have their own pasta.
Absolutely.
It's a huge deal there.
Yeah.
Completely. Now, you're a big fan of the spud, though. And obviously, I suppose it's gone out of fashion nowadays.
It has, sadly. And yet, it's one of the best foods around. It certainly would be my favourite food.
Mm.
And it's a very good source of calories. It's a very good source of vitamin C. And the Irish used to eat it. They'd have potatoes and milk. And the combination of those two almost give you a perfect nutrition. And so they thrived on it. A potato grows very quickly. So it only needs, say, 6 or 9 months. And you have a full crop. And it grows almost anywhere. So it was ideally suited to peasant farming in Ireland, where they had bad land. And also it was a crop that you could fill in between two crops.
Yeah.
So it was very popular in Ireland. Unfortunately, it became over popular. And when the blight eventually emerged from Europe into Ireland, it really devastated things here.
Yeah. And it's also, as I understand, it's a slow release food, which kind of helped people when they were working during the day.
Yeah, it is a slow release food. It's starch. And it's for me, it's a perfect food. And it's a shame to see it decline.
When did the spud then first come to Ireland?
Well, Christopher Columbus brought it to Spain first. And from Spain, it went into France, but it wasn't a particularly popular crop when it came. There are two reasons for that. One is it was part of the botanical family of deadly nightshade. And deadly nightshade was used as a poison.
Mm.
And secondly, at the time, the dietetics theory was that the higher a food was to God, the healthier it was. And the further away from God, the less healthy it was. So birds were better than, for example, swans,
yeah.
and trees were better than bushes. And bushes, but the worst of all was things that grow underground. They were the furthest you could be from God, and so there was a great suspicion of it. So, the story is of a, a, a pharmacist in the French army in the Franco-Prussian War. He was captured and he was imprisoned in Prussia, and he was fed on potatoes. Now, it may not have been popular with the peasants, but the prisoners had no option. He realised its nutritional value. When he returned to France, the grain crops had begun to fail. The aristocracy were terrified that the peasants would get up angst. And they set up a competition. And Parmentier, it was his name, Parmentier won the competition for the potato. So he tried a little trick, which I thought was very clever. He got 40 hectares on the suburbs of Paris, and he guarded the potato crop during the day, but let them go at night. And of course, the peasants came in, took the potatoes, tried them, realised they weren't poisonous, and realised that they could thrive on them. So slowly it took off.
That's interesting about the religious belief having an influence on what people eat. The same thing, as I understand it, had affected the attitude towards chocolate that was seen to be somewhat godless.
Yes, it's funny. I think there's two reasons why chocolate has gotten the name it has, because I don't think it merits it. It's not an aphrodisiac, and it's not a mind-bending drug. But the when the Spaniards went to Central America and conquered Mexico, the Aztecs were very fond of hallucinating mushrooms. Mm. And they would have consumed the hallucinating mushrooms in their coffee. And so the Dominicans and Jesuits that dominated the missionaries saw them going sort of doolally when they were drinking this stuff. Yeah. So they thought that it was the devil incarnate, and they were particularly concerned about chocolate being a source of libidinous thriving for women. And so there was a big battle between the Dominicans and the Jesuits over chocolate in Central America.
Though they did, as I understand it, well, some of them started exporting it back to Europe anyway.
Yeah, the Jesuits were amazing. They moved down into the Amazon region, and they were taking the chocolate berries. They enslaved would be the wrong word. They indentured, if you like, the local Amazonians to live in villages. And, of course, they were converting them to Catholicism as well. And one of the best historians of chocolate points out that the fathers used to ring a bell at night advising the couples that it was now time to have a bit of nookie. So, but they were the biggest exporters of chocolate from South America for many, many years.
Indeed, that's fascinating. Mike Gibney is Professor Emeritus of Food and Health at UCD and the author of Food Through the Ages, A Popular History. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.